This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Today on the show, we're going to explore the geopolitics of the COVID-19 pandemic and how the ongoing vaccine rollout is exacerbating the fault lines between rich and poor countries. Dr. Lindsay Newman, Director of Economics and Country Risk at IHS Markit, joins me to discuss this today. Good morning, Lindsay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So I want to start with the issue of vaccine diplomacy, which is becoming the catchphrase of the moment. How do you see vaccine diplomacy being used by different countries at this stage?
What we know thus far is that vaccines developed by only a small number of countries have really received some form of regulatory approval and availability for distribution. And so what this really means is that for much of 2021, at least, a wide number of countries are likely to remain vaccine importers. They're going to rely on securing access to supply of vaccines from a narrow band of externally developed vaccine. And so what this means is that some countries are looking to offset this risk through accessing vaccines across the board from as many suppliers as they can. Others are having to rely on pooled procurement schemes like COVAX. And what this is doing is it's opening up the door for, as you say, vaccine diplomacy, this buzzword of the moment, which is really, as we see it, where countries are who've been early movers on vaccine innovation and production, being able to jockey to become pivotal suppliers to these vaccine importers. And what this leaves these vaccine exporters to do is it's an extension and expression of their soft power. And it's nothing new. I mean, vaccine diplomacy isn't new. Mm-hmm. It's just because of the scope and scale of the COVID-19 pandemic that we're certainly hearing about it more, and that it's become this much more used channel of international relations, international engagement.
Mm. And China was arguably the first to play the vaccine diplomacy card. I mean, they were the first to, I guess, start experimenting with vaccines and the first to authorize their own homegrown vaccines. And also, I suppose, the first to offer their vaccines to other countries. Do you think that they've made the most of their first mover advantage?
As you say, what is interesting here is who has been active in this vaccine diplomacy space. It's not really countries like the U.S., which has really, as we've seen, held back sharing its excess vaccine supply, although we do expect the U.S. perhaps to sort of ease some of that vaccine nationalism in coming months and dip its toes into vaccine diplomacy. And Europe, too, has been quite embattled in its own vaccine delays and its rollout that we were all seeing splash across the news. So really, it's been other countries, as you say, like China, like India and Russia, that have been the most heavily involved in operating in this space. And for China, this is very much in line with their intention of gaining diplomatic support in this broader U.S.-China strategic competition, being seen as providing this public good, this public health good, which we saw early on with how China was providing PPE globally and around the world. Now it's vaccines. And there, what we're seeing, what our analysts are seeing, is that China is trying to position itself to be sort of at the hub, at the middle of a global health infrastructure supply chain. So in that sense, it has been successful. I mean, countries around the world are procuring vaccine from China.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, do you see any risks of this backfiring on China? Because while they have been distributing their multiple vaccines, we have the Sinovac vaccine, the Sinopharm, I think there are two others also available. At the same time, there's still questions about their efficacy. And is that going to bite them somewhere down the road, do you think?
Well, there is, of course, questions around efficacy and for all these vaccines. There are a lot of unknowns. I mean, what's remarkable is the acceleration of this R&D process that we've seen around vaccines. But we have to remember there are quite a few unknowns for all the vaccines. And China's vaccines are perhaps no different in that regard. There might be different types of unknowns around efficacy, but all the vaccines face questions around how long that they're going to be effective for. Do they actually curb transmission rates? So I don't see that as a specific risk necessarily for China. The issue is, there was before vaccine diplomacy and China's outreach through that channel, obviously was the Belt and Road Initiative and BRI, and how countries were starting to feel that there was not an equitable stake in those relationships. So the question I imagine becomes, at what cost are countries getting involved in these vaccine diplomacy relationships? For example, if we look at Russia, Russia's hoping to open the door for its pharmaceutical industry more broadly and seek other contracts for, you know, for its pharma sector. But then also, you know, as it engages with countries and develops these relationships that perhaps it hasn't historically had, will it open the door for infrastructure relationships? Will it open the door for it to provide and supply energy or foodstuffs? So the question is really, what are the longer term impacts around vaccine diplomacy, not just for China, but for all the countries that are both vaccine exporters and looking to advance some objective and some strategy? And what are the long term implications for those countries who are in a position where they really need the vaccine now, and perhaps they're negotiating power isn't as equitable.
I think that's a really good point. And it's so easy to see vaccine diplomacy as a charitable endeavor, that they're doing this because it's the right thing or the good thing to do. But there's always an agenda. There's always something that there's always something else that they're seeking for, essentially.
Yeah, as I said earlier, we really see vaccine diplomacy as just a new channel, an emerging frontier on international relations, on external and foreign affairs, right? So just as trade relationships, there sometimes are winners and losers, sometimes it's more equitable, and investment relationships, sometimes both sides feel that it was, you know, a win-win, and other times not the same. We expect very little different to be the case in vaccine diplomacy. Vaccine exporters are providing something that these vaccine importers really need. And in some instances, there will be longer term implications and perhaps risks and costs related to that.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a bit about India's vaccine diplomacy efforts? I mean, how do you see this unfolding? And does India have strengths in this area that perhaps some the country like China doesn't have?
So India is interesting because it's really, of China, Russia, and India, it's really the only one to have officially recognized its vaccine diplomacy program as a vaccine diplomacy program. It's called Vaccine Maitri, and it really is a concerted effort by the Indian government to focus regionally on providing vaccine support to offset growing Chinese influence. And India now is very plugged in with the Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Arrangement, which the U.S. government under the new administration of President Biden is really emphasizing, this relationship, this Quad relationship between India, Japan, Australia, and the United States. One of their main outputs of their first ever leader summit was to support India in its vaccine diplomacy program vis-a-vis China to offset Chinese regional influence. So India has the advantage of not just its own program and its relationship that it's developed through the Serum Institute, which is, you know, already one of the largest producers, manufacturers of vaccine globally, but now it seemingly have the support of the U.S., the Quad, Japan, and Australia to support this endeavor. What I would just briefly add, though, to that is that India is itself facing increasing numbers, you know, increasing COVID cases. So we've seen as a result of this recent increase in cases that it has had to perhaps at least temporarily pull back from its ambitions in this space, in the vaccine diplomacy space. We've seen that with Serum Institute saying that they are pausing exporting any of the AstraZeneca. So we have to remember that all of these countries that are engaged in this space in vaccine diplomacy are themselves dealing with their own domestic caseload of COVID. No countries have reached so-called herd immunity levels. No countries have eradicated COVID. So India is balancing this desire and these ambitions around vaccine diplomacy, this strategy around vaccine diplomacy, with its own very real increasing COVID-19 caseload.
Mm-hmm. Today on Pressing Matters, I'm speaking to Dr. Lindsay Newman, Director of Economics and Country Risk at IHS Markit, on the geopolitics of the vaccine rollout. We'll have more after these messages, including what's being done to address vaccine inequity. BFM 89.9. Hello, if you've just tuned in, this is Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. I'm Shazana, and with me on the show today is Dr. Lindsay Newman, Director of Economics and Country Risk at IHS Markit, for a discussion on the geopolitics of vaccines. Earlier on the show, we talked about vaccine diplomacy and how countries like China, India, and Russia are leveraging their positions as vaccine exporters to build on soft power. In contrast, Lindsay, as you mentioned, developed countries have been much more tight-fisted with their vaccine supplies. Why do you think richer countries have been slow to leverage vaccine diplomacy, despite having more resources? Is it down to the severity of the domestic COVID situations?
I think it's important that we separate out the countries from each other, because what the EU has opted to do is very different, and the logic behind it is very different than, say, the UK or the US. The EU has adopted a completely cohesive approach. They could have not adopted a completely cohesive approach and allowed for each country in the EU to secure their own vaccines individually as countries. But they took a decision early on to negotiate as a bloc with the vaccine producing firms under the impression that that would benefit them and enable them to have a stronger negotiating power around price and around things like IP protections and liability. And so their approach has been to take a cohesive approach, and they're now struggling under a key risk that we're seeing, which is a shared risk that a lot of countries are facing, that there's a gap between actual access and supply of COVID-19 vaccine, which means that, you know, you may have secured theoretically enough vaccine under the APAs, but you cannot get it. Logistical issues, infrastructure issues, supply chain issues mean that you do not have the supply in your country or in your region domestically available right now. So the EU is not in a position, really, it feels, to share the vaccine because it doesn't have a glut of vaccine. There are very few countries, really, that have enough vaccine on hand. I can think really only of the US and Israel that actually have enough vaccine on hand to meet the demand of their domestic population. There's that second set of countries like the and regions like the EU, like the UK, like Japan, like Canada, that actually they have advanced purchase agreements in place that if delivered upon would provide enough vaccines for their populations. But again, they have not yet necessarily received all that vaccine. And so what this is driving is this sort of sharp elbows, this sort of vaccine nationalism, where thus far countries that may have secured enough vaccine or may have vaccine in place, they're just not in the friendly spirit. They're not in the sharing spirit yet. And again, we fully expect that this will ease as these levels of vaccination, domestic vaccination, reach sort of herd immunity levels or reach an overwhelming proponent of the population. We're seeing this already with the U.S. They just recently named Gail Smith, formerly with the USAID, to lead as the global coordinator for COVID response. And that's a real key indicator that the U.S. is going to be shifting away from this sort of vaccine nationalist approach, easing the vaccine nationalism more towards vaccine diplomacy. As you said earlier, as part of this public good, as part of this belief that there is a responsibility to help support the global effort to end the pandemic. And then, of course, there's a third set of countries that, are absolutely do not have anywhere near enough vaccine supply in place or advanced purchase agreements in place to meet the population demand. And that's that's what's driving the vaccine diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. And that's where initiatives like COVAX is supposed to come in and kind of help to bridge that vaccine inequity. Could you talk us through why COVAX has been slow to take off the ground? Is it because of the issues of supply and manufacture and just trying to get the different buyers satisfied before it's channeled to COVAX?
COVAX, as you say, is a pooled procurement scheme, which was set up to alleviate some of these pressures. But what's really important to keep in mind about COVAX before sort of getting to the second part about where the supply is coming from is that the initial promise of COVAX is only to provide participating countries enough vaccine to cover 20% of their populations, right? So that's great, but it will not be enough. It's unlikely to be enough to achieve domestic herd immunity. So even under access to COVAX, countries are still going to need to look elsewhere for their supply. So that's the headline that, that we always need to bear in mind. why and if COVAX has been slower to kick off than maybe initially hoped or, you know, planned, it is exactly as you say. I mean, it is the constraints that all countries are facing around supply chain. We've heard recently in the news about some issues of vaccines, you know, needing to be disposed of because they weren't up to standards or whatnot. So, you know, all the constraints around supply chain and intricacies of supply chain that have filtered into why domestic rollouts have perhaps been slower than expected in some cases are also hitting COVAX.
Mm-hmm. What are the other options being debated in international fora about how to solve vaccine inequity if COVAX is only but one part of the bigger picture? Because as you say, they only supply 20%. I guess, what are the other options being talked about?
Ultimately, it was a global collaborative effort to contain COVID-19 that drove forward the very accelerated, you know, R&D efforts and investments and developments that have put us in a position now that we have a number of effective vaccines already available and a pipeline of several dozen vaccines that are currently in phase 2 and 3 trials. So what's being debated and what's being considered by international institutions, multilateral institutions like the WTO, is how do we continue to leverage and capitalize on this collaborative, this global goodwill that we saw in the vaccine development race, now in the vaccine deployment, in the vaccine rollouts. And so there's the questions around whether, for example, IP protections should be loosened. And that's been something that has been debated for several months now. The WTO has its own proposal to at least temporarily suspend patent rights for COVID-19 treatments and vaccines. And we've seen that has pretty widespread support by those countries in need. I think something like 58 countries have indicated that they support the WTO's proposal. But you need to get both sides in the equation, not just those who, you know, support it because they need that loosening and the opportunities to perhaps produce their, you know, have openings to produce their own of these already tested vaccines. But also you need countries and companies that have helped support these vaccine manufacturers to play ball too and say, yeah, we also agree and support this sort of at least temporary loosening of IP protections. And what we're seeing is that it's gaining some support in the US, for example, domestically within Congress. And that's a key indicator to watch because, you know, the US does have the opportunity to show leadership in this space if they are supportive of IP loosenings, then so hopefully perhaps other countries would go. And the logic again there is that, you know, vaccinating everyone is a public good. Also importantly, you know, we've seen some companies, I mean, Moderna has said that they would not enforce COVID vaccine patent rights during the pandemic. So it might be that this isn't a permanent, I don't think anybody's contemplating a permanent loosening of IP protections. And there's a whole host of sort of economic reasons why we wouldn't want to do that. But it may be that we just see sort of it become easier or cheaper for governments to purchase IP rights or IP licenses to facilitate local production opportunities and capacity. Because a number of countries do have production and local pharma manufacturing either in development or already in place, but it's about having those relationships and to actually produce the vaccine, which is, you know, not yet there for most countries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One final question, Lindsay, before we let you go. We know that the longer the pandemic goes on and the longer economies are disrupted, there's greater risk for political and social unrest. Which regions and countries do you think might be more prone to civil unrest if the pandemic is not brought under control through, you know, quicker vaccine rollouts or mitigation measures?
Absolutely right. Even as vaccine campaigns are underway, government containment measures, local lockdowns, perhaps less so national lockdowns, are likely to persist in the coming months. And these restrictions reduce levels of economic activity for governments to perhaps below pre-COVID levels. And it also means that fiscal stimulus or support benefits packages are going to be reconsidered and perhaps, you know, pulled back. So this is a key mechanism for how and why we might see unrest opportunities for unrest or outbreaks of unrest in certain areas in the world. And, you know, we're keeping an eye for such risks across parts of Africa. Ghana is a country that we've identified there, as well as Latin America, particularly countries where there are higher informal sector activity like Peru, Bolivia, and Argentina, and as I said, where the governments have already perhaps suggested that they might pull back support benefits, such as Brazil. And I'm sure, you know, your audience will be very aware that there have been some protests across Southeast Asia over the last year or so, you know, related loosely to COVID, government response, government containment measures. And so those areas that we've seen, Indonesia, of course, Myanmar, less so the Philippines, there's some ongoing activity in Thailand and Bangkok. The driver is how effectively governments are rolling out vaccines, how effectively they're containing COVID, and how open and reopen economies are able to be, so that, you know, so we can drive forward these health and economic recoveries. And there are going to be growing pains over the next few, you know, at least over the next few months, as these vaccine rollouts continue to be deployed.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, thank you so much for your insights. That was fascinating. And we hope to catch up with you again further down the line to see how things have panned out throughout the year.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking to Dr. Lindsay Newman, Director of Economics and Country Risk at IHS Markit, on the geopolitics of the vaccine rollout. This has been Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. Stay tuned for the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next. And after that, more great conversations on enterprise. BFM 89.9.